Welcome to the Deep Dive from Mohawk Valley Voice. Today, we're digging into something quite serious that's been documented across the U.S.
That's right. We're looking at this increasing trend, the criminalization of pregnancy outcomes, specifically things like miscarriage and stillbirth.
Yeah, not abortion, but loss. And to get a handle on this, we've looked at quite a few sources.
We have. We're drawing from recent reporting, AP News, WV Metro News, The Marshall Project, PBS NewsHour, and also some deeper analysis from a Human Rights Watch report, the Brennan Center for Justice.
And even dipping into specific state law, like the West Virginia Code.
Right. So our goal here, really, is to understand what these sources tell us about the legal changes driving this.
And the real-world impact, you know, what people are actually facing, the human cost.
Exactly. And importantly, how these documents suggest women are being, well, marginalized and their fundamental autonomy is being challenged.
Okay, so let's start with the legal landscape. Everything really shifted after the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision back in June 2022.
It really did. That decision overturned the constitutional right to abortion, basically handing regulation back to individual states.
And the Human Rights Watch report we looked at, it quantifies that immediately. It says something like 22 million women and girls of reproductive age suddenly found themselves living in states where abortion was heavily restricted or just, you know, not accessible.
A huge number. And what sources like the Marshall Project and PBS NewsHour really highlight is this direct link between that legal shift and this broader push for something called fetal personhood.
Fetal personhood. Can you unpack that a bit?
Sure. It's basically the idea or the movement to grant a fetus the same legal rights and protections as a person who has been born.
Okay, I see. And according to the Marshall Project, the Brennan Center, PBS, this isn't just a philosophical debate.
Yeah.
It's having real consequences.
Absolutely. They draw a line directly from this push to the increase we're seeing in investigations and even prosecutions of pregnant people for outcomes that aren't abortion. We're talking miscarriage, stillbirth.
And there are numbers attached to this.
There are, and they're frankly startling. The Marshall Project and PBS NewsHour, they cite this group, Pregnancy Justice.
Okay.
And they found that in just the first year after Dobbs, so June 22 to June 23, there were at least 210 pregnancy-related prosecutions documented.
210?
Yeah.
In 1 year?
Yeah. And that's reportedly the highest number documented in a single year since 1973, since Roe v. Wade.
Wow. That really paints a picture of acceleration, doesn't it?
It does. And the sources show how this is happening legally. States aren't necessarily passing brand new laws specifically for miscarriage. Instead, they're often stretching or reinterpreting existing laws.
Like what kind of laws?
Things originally meant for child abuse or neglect, even abuse of a corpse statutes. They're being applied in these new contexts against pregnant individuals.
Abuse of a corpse. That sounds extreme in this context.
It does. And that brings us to what this looks like for actual people, you know, on the ground. The source materials give some really difficult examples.
Let's talk about those. I know one case that got a lot of attention. Brittany Watts in Ohio. AB News. PBS covered it.
Yes, that's a key example. She miscarried at home around 22 weeks. The sources note the pregnancy was already considered non-viable.
Okay.
But weeks later, she was charged. A felony charge for abuse of a corpse based on how she handled the fetal remains.
For how she handled the remains after a miscarriage.
Exactly. And the analysis in the PBS piece from legal experts really pointed out that prosecutors were, in effect, criticizing how she grieved, how she dealt with the situation physically and emotionally.
That's hard to process. Did the prosecutor's office say why?
Well, the AP News report quotes them saying they felt compelled to move forward with the case. That word compelled really jumps out.
Compelled. Wow. Okay. And the Marshall Project you mentioned had other examples.
Yes, another really tough one. Catherine Green in Oklahoma. She had a stillbirth. Initially, she was charged with murder.
Murder for a stillbirth?
Initially, yes. That charge was later reduced, but she still faced charges for child neglect and, again, unauthorized disposal or desecration of a human corpse.
What happened in her case?
It's complex. The Marshall Project details how the cause of the stillbirth was disputed. The medical examiner initially pointed to meth toxicity, but that ME apparently had a history of issues.
Okay, so doubt about the cause.
Right. An expert for Green suggested an infection was more likely. The judge, even while saying he wasn't convinced she willfully harmed the baby with drug use, still sentenced her to drug treatment and probation.
And made comments.
Yes, comments about her supposed lack of maternal instinct. The Marshall Project really emphasizes the lasting shame she feels, even though she took an Alford plea, meaning she maintained innocence, but acknowledged the prosecution might have enough evidence for a conviction.
It sounds incredibly traumatic, compounded by the legal system.
Absolutely. And then there's Annie Bynum in Arkansas, also from the Marshall Project report. Jailed, sent to prison for concealing a stillbirth.
Concealing a stillbirth.
Yeah, the source explains these are often very old laws, originally designed centuries ago, frankly, to shame unmarried women. And now they're finding new life in this context.
So old laws repurposed for this new landscape.
Precisely. And it's important to note, as sources like Human Rights Watch and the Marshall Project point out, citing NPR, this didn't just start with Dobbs. Remember the case of Bei Shuai in Indiana? Back in 2011, she faced murder and feticide charges after attempting suicide while pregnant. So the groundwork, sadly, was already there.
What seems common across these cases, based on the sources?
A key thing highlighted particularly by the Marshall Project is that these investigations often kick off based on suspicion.
Suspicion about what?
About the woman's actions or maybe her intentions. Did she seem like she didn't want the baby? Did she wait to call 911 after a loss? Did she search online for abortion information, even if she ultimately miscarried?
So not necessarily clear evidence of a crime, but suspicion about her behavior or attitude.
Exactly. And as legal experts like Madeline Wasilchuk, cited in the Marshall Project, argue, women are effectively being punished for how they react to the trauma of pregnancy loss.
Instead of getting support, they're facing suspicion, potentially prosecution.
That's the picture the sources paint, and it goes beyond just these direct criminal charges.
Okay.
Well, the anti-abortion laws themselves and just the fear of criminalization that the sources document are having wider negative effects on women's health and healthcare access.
Right. The chilling effect.
Precisely. The Human Rights Watch report goes into significant detail here. They document cases where women face delays or were even denied care for miscarriages.
Delays in miscarriage care. That sounds dangerous.
It can be. The report mentions risks like hemorrhage, serious infection like sepsis, life-threatening stuff. And it's happening because hospitals or doctors are afraid of violating strict, sometimes vague abortion bans.
They also mention ectopic pregnancies, right? Where the pregnancy is non-viable from the start.
Yes. A condition that always requires treatment. HRW documented an Ohio patient having to travel to Michigan for care. A Wisconsin woman bleeding at home for over 10 days after an incomplete miscarriage because the hospital was hesitant.
That's terrifying. And it affects doctors, too.
Definitely. The HRW report describes healthcare professionals feeling forced to withhold information or make medical decisions that aren't optimal purely out of legal fear.
And that could lead to fewer doctors wanting to practice in these states.
That's a documented concern, yeah. Provider shortages, especially for OBGYNs, which just makes access harder for everyone.
And what about patients? How does this fear affect them seeking care?
Well, the sources suggest people might avoid healthcare they need, including prenatal care, because they're afraid of being watched, surveyed, or potentially reported.
Like if they have a history of substance use or something.
Exactly. HRW cites Tennessee, where prenatal care visits reportedly dropped after a law criminalizing prenatal drug use went into effect. People feared contact with the system.
And does this affect other reproductive healthcare too?
Yes, according to Human Rights Watch. When clinics that provide abortions closed because of state bans, they often also provided things like contraception, STI testing, cancer screenings. So access to those services gets reduced too.
Okay, so healthcare access is one major area. What else? You mentioned surveillance.
Yes, digital privacy. This is a huge concern detailed in the HRW report. Law enforcement is increasingly using digital data trails.
Like what kind of data?
Location data from phones, internet search history, messages, even data from period tracking apps, all potentially used to investigate or build a case related to pregnancy outcomes.
Is there an example of this happening?
Yes. The report cites the pre-Dobbs case of Latisse Fisher. Her search history was used against her after she experienced a stillbirth at home. It shows how your digital life can become evidence.
And how are police getting this data? Do they always need warrants?
Not always, apparently. The sources note that sometimes they can just buy it from data brokers. It's a largely unregulated market.
They can just buy location data.
HRW mentions journalists who are able to buy location data showing people visiting abortion clinics relatively cheaply. So, yes.
And the U.S. doesn't have strong federal laws protecting this kind of digital privacy.
Not comprehensively, no. Which, as HRW points out, makes this risk even greater now, post-Dobbs. Your digital footprint is potentially quite exposed.
Okay, so we have criminalization, healthcare impacts, privacy threats. Thinking about who is most affected by all this, do the sources say if it impacts everyone equally?
No, definitely not. This is a key finding across the sources, especially Human Rights Watch. These impacts fall hardest on already marginalized communities.
Which groups are mentioned specifically?
The IPOC women, particularly Black women, low-income individuals, people living in rural areas, migrants, young people, LGBTQ plus individuals, people with disabilities.
And why them? What makes them more vulnerable to these effects?
It's because, as HRW explains, they often already face significant barriers, difficulty accessing healthcare, systemic discrimination, fewer economic resources. These laws and the fear they create just pile on top of those existing problems.
Compounding existing inequalities.
Exactly. HRW even connects it to historical context. Like the, yes, connecting restricted abortion access to the higher rates of sexual violence experienced in some marginalized communities. Even when state bans have exceptions for rape or incest, accessing them is often difficult.
Why is that?
Because they frequently required reporting the assault to the police, which HRW points out is less common or feasible for many survivors, especially in marginalized groups or in cases of family violence.
And then there's just the practical side of getting care if you live in a state with a ban. Travel. Cost.
Huge factors. The increased travel distances and the costs involved disproportionately affect low-income individuals and women of color who may simply not have the resources to travel out of state. HRW and the Marshall Project cite studies showing how much farther people now have to travel,
making abortion effectively inaccessible for many, even if it's legal elsewhere.
Precisely. And HRW references the Turnaway study findings here.
Oh yeah, I've heard of that.
It tracked women who sought abortions. Some got them, some were turned away. The study found that being denied an abortion leads to worse economic outcomes, increased poverty for those women and their existing children. It just reinforces hardship.
So bringing all these threads together, the legal cases, the healthcare barriers, the disproportionate impact, what's the underlying theme the sources point to?
It really comes down to autonomy. Decisional autonomy. The sources, particularly Human Rights Watch and the Brennan Center, frame this entire situation as a fundamental denial of women's right to make decisions about their own bodies, their health, and their lives.
They use pretty strong language, don't they?
They do. Phrases like denying decisional and bodily autonomy, rejecting women's agency, dignity, and equality. Calling these laws expansive public intrusions and personal decisions based just on someone's pregnancy status.
So the criminalization of miscarriage, the fear preventing access to care, the surveillance, it's all presented as undermining a woman's control over her own life.
That's the core argument presented in these analyses, yes.
Hmm.
That these governmental actions directly impede a woman's ability to manage her reproductive health and, consequently, her future, her equality.
And is there an international perspective on this?
There is. Human Rights Watch brings in international human rights law, arguing that these kinds of restrictions violate fundamental rights, the right to life, health, privacy, equality, freedom from discrimination.
And they mention the UN?
Yes, noting that UN human rights experts have actually called the situation in the U.S. after Dobbs a human rights crisis.
A human rights crisis. That's a powerful statement.
It is. And navigating this landscape, as we touched on, can be incredibly confusing for women, even within one state's laws. The West Virginia example really highlights that.
Right. Tell us about that again. There seemed to be a contradiction.
Exactly. So WV Metro News reported a county prosecutor saying state law doesn't prevent charging someone for improper disposal of fetal remains after a miscarriage. But West Virginia has another law, the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. And that law, as cited in the sources, explicitly says its provisions do not apply to the acts or omissions of a pregnant woman regarding her own pregnancy.
So one official says charges are possible, but another state law seems to say they aren't, specifically for the pregnant woman herself.
That's the confusion the sources reveal. It perfectly illustrates how uncertain and potentially dangerous the legal ground is for someone experiencing pregnancy loss. What's legal, what's not, can be really unclear.
Creating fear and potential traps.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's try to summarize what we've learned from these sources today. We're seeing a definite shift post-Dobbs, where the idea of fetal personhood is being used to justify criminal investigations and prosecutions for pregnancy outcomes like miscarriage and stillbirth.
Right. And this isn't theoretical. There are documented cases and the numbers are rising. This has knock-on effects, serious negative impacts on women's health, access to care, privacy due to surveillance.
And these burdens, critically, are not shared equally. Marginalized communities are disproportionately harmed, making existing inequalities even worse.
And the common thread running through all of this, as highlighted by the analyses we looked at, is the erosion of women's autonomy, their fundamental right to make decisions about their own bodies and lives.
So a final thought for you, our listener, reflecting on all this. Consider what it means for a society when something as common and often traumatic as a miscarriage could potentially lead to criminal investigation.
Yeah, or when seeking necessary medical care comes with a documented fear of being watched or reported, when your basic rights and equality might feel dependent on whether or not you're pregnant.
The Brennan Center analysis suggests that recognizing a woman's ability to make her own decisions isn't just about individual well-being. It's fundamental to a just society, to being able to participate fully and equally. Something to really think about.
It truly is. This is obviously a complex and deeply personal issue with massive implications. We hope this dive into the sources helps you continue to learn and engage with it.
This Deep Dive was produced by David Laguerre.
Thanks so much for listening to This Deep Dive.
Please do share it if you found it valuable, and feel free to leave a comment on whatever platform you're using to listen.